On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's UN time again for George Bush. 4 years and 1 week ago, the American president stood before the UN General Assembly and made his case for war against an Iraq he warned was stockpiling weapons of mass destruction. The UN balked. The U.S. went to war anyway. The WMD never showed up. And bringing democracy to the Middle East became the White House battle cry. Today, the president asks the world community to stand up for peace. But it's not clear the world is with the U.S. agenda on Iraq, on Israel and the Palestinians, on Iran's nuclear program, and more. Up next, On Point, George Bush at the UN and American leadership in the world now. Joining me first today from the United Nations in New York is Carol Giacomo, diplomatic correspondent for Reuters News Service. Carol, thanks for being with us. Set the stage for us. Aspirations and opposition as the president comes to the UN?
Well, President Bush has a hard audience, as you mentioned today. He's going to be talking about his Middle East policy. He's going to be urging nations of the world to stand up for peace by supporting Middle East moderates over extremists. But he's also coming under a lot of pressure for his policy in Iraq, and he's facing a very daunting task in trying to work out some sort of deal with Iran over nuclear weapons.
What does the United States need from the UN as he speaks today?
He needs a lot of support, both in trying to put pressure on Iran to give up its nuclear programs. He needs support from the UN in trying to push some sort of peace settlement in Sudan. He needs support for his perception of a settlement between Palestinians and Israel. He's got a very hefty agenda.
And what about the audience here? It was 4 years ago the president went before the UN asking for UN backing to deal with Iraq in terms that suggested that might very well mean war. He did not finally get that from the Security Council. The U.S. went in anyway. How has that played out over these last 4 years? What about American standing in this assembly hall?
Well, you know, the United States is facing a more and more critical world. Bush's own popularity in the United States has decreased. His standing worldwide has also taken a beating, and the American image overseas has also been battered. In terms of the situation in Iraq, which seems to be getting increasingly worse, UN Secretary Kofi Annan, in a very gloomy message yesterday, criticized the issued a warning about Iraq that it was in danger of descending into civil war. And Kofi Annan doesn't usually speak out quite so forcefully on these issues, particularly as with the United States in the lead.
The Bush administration is describing things differently. We see the Assistant Secretary of State, Kristen Silverberg, saying recently, this is a time of real opportunity for the Security Council, also a time when we're really testing its resolve. Who's being tested here?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, both sides, I think. The Americans have, after a long period in which Bush really pursued a very unilateral program, or what people perceived as a unilateralist approach, is now heavily leaning on the United States to try to promote its agenda in the Middle East with North Korea and Sudan. And so to that extent, the UN really is on the line, because many countries of the world, the major powers, have bought in to the Bush approach on a lot of these issues, including Iran. I mean, the UN Security Council in July passed a resolution which said Iran should suspend nuclear uranium enrichment by August 31st, or they would move towards sanctions.
Well, bought in to some degree, but every time the U.S. now moves back to talking about Chapter 7 and potential military action, it seems nobody's at its side. Jacques Chirac most recently on Iran.
Well, Well, the U.S. really isn't talking about military action right now. They're still focused on diplomacy, and they say that moving towards sanctions is part of this diplomacy.
But even there, the French leaders did not, yes. Didn't he seem to say, no, thank you?
Well, yes. Yesterday, he did seem to be much more sort of wishy-washy about his willingness to go along with sanctions. Today, he is his comments are a little less in that vein. He came out and said just a little while ago that Iran must suspend uranium enrichment before talks can take place. So it's a little bit of a question as to exactly what the state of play is right now. Clearly, the Europeans, the French and the Germans and the British would like to push the diplomatic track as hard as they can. They really want to see what they can do to try to make talks work. The Americans have always played the bad cop. They see their role as playing the bad cop, and they also believe much more firmly that sanctions are ultimately going to have to be imposed at some level in order to make Iran do anything.
The bad cop in chief stepping into the General Assembly today, but with what the White House hopes will be a positive message as well about freedom. Carol Giacomo with Reuters, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I want to turn to two guests now to look at the broader picture as the president prepares to make his address today. Joining us from Providence, Rhode Island, Thomas Bierstecker. He's professor of transnational organizations at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. Thomas Bierstecker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Washington, Lee Feinstein. He's senior fellow at the U.S. Foreign for U.S. Foreign Policy and International Law at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lee Feinstein, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure to join you.
Thomas Bierstecker, first to you. The institution that the President of the United States faces today, as opposed to that that other presidents have faced in years past, the chemistry here, how do you judge it?
Well, I agree with Carol that I think it's a very hard audience for the president, particularly given the past history with recent policies and the opposition to the U.S. invasion and continued occupation of Iraq. And I think it'll be particularly difficult if he does, as we've been told, pursue the discussion of his freedom agenda and plans for the Islamic world. I think it'll be very difficult, in part because of the erosion of both moral authority and leadership of the U.S. over the course of the past 4 or 5 years.
Lee Feinstein, when the president came last time, he and others in his administration effectively said to the U.N. about Iraq, stand up and act or you will be proven useless. So now we've had 4 years. What's been proven?
Well, what's been proven is that if you act without broad international support on a difficult international subject like Iraq, it's much harder to do business. That's, I think, what's been proven. What's also happened, though, is that there's been some serious rethinking about what the UN's roles and purposes are since the Security Council meltdown over Iraq in 2003. There's an opportunity, unfortunately, has not been pursued very aggressively to improve things.
What's that rethinking look like, and who's doing it?
Well, after 2003, Annan gave an important speech about the UN, as did President Bush, about the UN's relevancy. Annan authorized a group called the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change, which included the former Bush National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, to look at what the UN was supposed to do in the 21st century. Mm. One of the things that they agreed on was this idea that the UN should be much more effective in dealing with mass atrocities. And in fact, last year, the UN unanimously supported a principle called the responsibility to protect, which is now being tested, and a test so far that nations are failing.
In Darfur, Exhibit A. Okay, so stand up to genocide. What other rethinking here?
Well, there are a whole battery of management reforms that have been considered. There's also an effort to recreate the Human Rights Commission, which was discredited and has been replaced with a Human Rights Council, which is better, but still, unfortunately, a pallid compromise. The UN has also created something called the Peacebuilding Commission, which is to apply a much more systematic and rigorous effort at nation building after a military intervention, the same kind of effort that has normally been associated with going in militarily to make those investments pay off and help nations rebuild after a conflict.
Thomas Bierstecker, what have we learned in these past 4 years about who needs whom in this relationship. President Bush, perhaps more than any president in living memory, prepared to be very critical of the United Nations. But what have we learned about where the needs are here?
Well, I think there is a tendency among the administration to blame the United Nations for its shortcomings, the shortcomings of the institution. And while there are significant administrative deficiencies, I think many of the shortcomings are attributable to the actions of its member states and the reluctance to implement UN Security Council resolutions. I was interested in your question earlier of Carol about who's being tested here. It's not just the U.S. versus the U.N. In many ways, it's the U.S. versus the other member states, and particularly the other members of the other permanent five members of the Security Council.
So France, Germany, U.K., Russia, China, all being tested here. Is the president seen as having right on his side in putting them to a test? Is he seen as being in a position to do that?
Well, I think that's, again, as I said earlier, the biggest problem in terms of the difficulty of the audience, although it's important to point out two things about the U.N. One is the necessity of the United Nations for the resolution of so many global problems. It's not certainly not the only forum, and that's why bilateral or the six-party talks on North Korea or other types of arrangements are necessary. The UN's not the only forum, but it's frequently a vital forum for legitimizing collective action of the international community and for effective implementation of the resolution of many ongoing conflicts. Mm. So sooner or later, you have to take it to the UN, as we learned in the case of Iraq.
We've been joined by Thomas Bierstecker, a professor at Brown University, author of Countering the Financing of Global Terrorism and the Emergence of Private Authority in Global Governance. Lee Feinstein is with us as well from the Council on Foreign Relations. He was an expert on the Congressional Task Force on the United Nations, which wrote the Gingrich-Mitchell Report in 2005 on reforming the UN, former Defense and State Department official in the Clinton administration. Right now, Robert's calling from Philadelphia. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I realize the president is speaking today at the UN, but just taking us back a few years to when the U.S. did have integrity in the United Nations and tried to do something for the betterment. And we had a lot of goodwill, but I think that goodwill has now been wasted or lost even after the tragedy that was 9/11. And I really believe that Bush is he doesn't have any validity anymore, and I'm sorry to say that because I really believe in the United States and I believe in the UN.
That's a big statement to make about the president of the United States standing before the UN. But let me put it to our panel, Lee Feinstein. There's a big one. Robert wants to know about U.S. standing, U.S. integrity, goodwill in the UN toward the United States at this point. How would you measure it? How do we measure it?
Well, one way to measure it is where the rest of the institution is, where the other countries are on major issues of importance to the United States. And here, even though President Bush is clearly not very popular at the UN, there's much more agreement at the UN about large goals with the United States than there has been in the past. So, for example, on this question of genocide, you have in the past, most of the countries of the world would have opposed any kind of effort that might have been seen as illegal intervention into the domestic affairs of a country, even in the face of genocide. And now you've got a majority of countries, in fact, last year, all countries agreeing that what happens, mass atrocities that happen in one country, are the responsibility of all countries, and the classical excuses for doing nothing no longer apply. Also, even in terms of management reform, I mean, there's been a big split between the United States and the developing world on the questions of management reform. But there's no
management of the United Nations itself.
Of the United Nations, right. But there's no doubt on the key issues, most of the countries of the world, including in sub-Saharan Africa, even the countries in the non-aligned movement, which tend to see themselves in opposition to the United States, want a much more effective peacekeeping operation. They want much more effective programs to deal with human rights. They want more effective programs to deal with poverty, with HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, other diseases. So there's a lot of agreement about what the UN ought to be doing, and there's much less ideological division than, say, there was even in the middle of the 90s.
Thomas Bierstecker, help us make sense of this picture then. On the one hand, we're told This is not going to be a friendly audience for President Bush. On the other, Lee Feinstein looks at actual policy issues and says there's more agreement with the U.S. than there has been in a long time. Does that mean that whatever it has done for his popularity standing, President Bush's sort of give him hell Harry style has worked or not?
Well, I think it's not the style that's worked. I think it's simply a convergence of goals on the part of other member states. For example, there has, in addition to, I agree with Lee on the importance of the responsibility to protect and the movement on consensus on genocide. But, of course, one has to counter that by looking at the lack of action on Darfur. Mm. Another arena, though, where there's been an extraordinary amount of cooperation and oftentimes not adequately recognized, I think, is the amount of cooperation on counterterrorism and the very central role that the United Nations has been playing in essentially taking the American regulatory regime of targeting sanctions and controls on financial transfers and, in fact, in a sense, globalizing that regime with the operations of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban Sanctions Committee. So there are lots of issues. I think that in many ways I agree that there's a lot of agreement on large goals, but diplomacy is important here, and the tone of the speech is, I think, very important. That is, there needs to be a tone of reconciliation, of acknowledgement of the legitimacy of other views and disagreements.
So what about the president's theme then, Lee Feinstein, of freedom, the freedom message from the White House? Is that one likely to resonate here, or is this at some level all kind of a surface theatrics? If they're agreeing on fundamental policy, does it really matter if the president's explicit themes resonate or not?
It's too late for this president to win a popularity contest at the United Nations, and that should not be the goal of his speech in any event. The United States needs to take some principled positions. I think one of the most important things that the president can do today is reestablish high ground for the United States on the question of Iran and Iran's nuclear program. The United States has gotten itself in a position where it now looks like the principal obstacle to a negotiated outcome on Iran's nuclear program.
Explain what you mean by that, if you could, Lee.
Sure. Well, you know, the reason the talks between the European Union and Iran over its nuclear program broke down was because Iran restarted nuclear activities, uranium enrichment activities, which it said it would suspend for the duration of the negotiation. So once it did that, the EU, the European Union, had no choice but to stop. So the United States joined with the European Union and said, hey, look, if you go back to the negotiations on the basis of resuming your suspension, there are a lot of incentives that we can provide, and we'll do this together, the four of us. Mm. This is a big deal. Unfortunately, though, what's happened is Iran has played a very good diplomatic game, offered to rejoin the negotiations and restart the negotiations. In the meantime, Russia and China have criticized the American approach, which emphasizes sanctions. And so it looks like the United States is the main obstacle to returning to the negotiations. I think what the president needs to do today is make it very clear that, one, that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, and that that's beyond doubt, and that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN organization, has established that, that it's violated its obligations under various nuclear agreements. And two, that, the United States wants to return to the negotiating table with Iran, and that the reason these negotiations broke down was because of actions, unilateral actions, that the Iranians took. I think this is extremely important. Right now, it looks like the United States has been outmaneuvered on this question.
Thomas Bierstecker, how about the Iran picture here? You've got, of course, the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad also speaking today. Off the dais, away from the podium there, who's going to be taking more flack? Is the world really rallying around, or for that matter, just Security Council members rallying around the U.S. high cry of warning about Iran's nukes? Or do we still have, foot dragging and resistance? I mean, it was 4 years ago the president was making a similar cry about Iraq, so is the U.N. prepared to listen and follow on Iran?
Well, I think because of the presentation on Iraq several years ago, I think that's one reason why the credibility is so low at the moment. I suspect that what's underway today is, in a sense, we're going to have a a presentation of the debate that was declined with President Ahmadinejad. In a sense, President Bush will be speaking first. President Ahmadinejad will be speaking later.
So not face-to-face, but President Bush, in effect, answering Ahmadinejad's challenges.
Or, in fact, laying some of the agenda and setting the tone. I think it would be interesting, as Lee suggested, if, in fact, he began by invoking the IAEA rather than U.S. intelligence information as the basis for making the argument. That would be what I meant earlier in terms of a reconciliatory measure, acknowledgement of the role of the United Nations.
Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
We're all right. What do you think, Matt?
My question or my point is, it seems like all this talk with the UN, nothing gets done. Now, the UN is absolutely useless. I mean, if you not useless, but if you think about it, going back to the first Gulf War, half the stuff that we told Saddam not to do, he did. Wasn't Hezbollah supposed to disarm? And I mean, the UN has absolutely no teeth. And then when somebody tries to put the hammer down on these agreements that they've supposedly made that people were supposed to follow, Hamas being the biggest one, or Hezbollah, I'm sorry. Nothing gets done.
So what do you take from that, Matt? Then, I mean, we see what's happened in Iraq. It hasn't been easy. Everybody says the U.S. could use more support there. Let's say, for a moment, by your view, that the U.N. is often less than really effective. What does that mean for the U.S.?
It means that we're basically going to be in the same position that we're in right now, because if you think about it, they don't do anything. They say stuff. They stand up there. They grandstand. They make these 1447 resolutions or whatever they are, and then they pick and choose which ones they want to do. How come nobody's telling Hezbollah to disarm?
Matt, let us pick it up. Thomas Biersticker, you know, this is exactly the view that George Bush has ridden to great effect. The UN is useless. What about the UN effectiveness question here as the president stands before the General Assembly?
Well, in many ways, I think if we didn't have a United Nations, we'd have to invent one. The problem is that many issues, one of the Watson Institute board members, Sir Brian Urquhart, has commented that issues typically arrive at the United Nations when everyone else has given up on trying to solve them or resolve them. So oftentimes the problems are extraordinarily difficult and very intractable. But just a couple of recent actions or activities of effectiveness. And let me just point out the UN was absolutely essential in legitimating the intervention in Afghanistan against the Taliban. As I mentioned earlier, it's been absolutely essential in globalizing the effort to counter the financing of terrorism. As Lee pointed out, it's engaged in increased peacekeeping operations with the new Peacebuilding Commission, but also peacekeeping operations globally, many times far more effectively, cost-effectively, than the commitment of U.S. troops. So I think we have to recognize it's certainly not a perfect organization, but in fact its accomplishments are significant in my view.
Lee Feinstein, you hear our caller Matt's frustration with the UN. He points to the Hezbollah and the non-disarmament there. What about the effectiveness argument?
Well, let me answer this in two ways. First of all, the idea that the UN doesn't do anything, an argument I understand. The fact of the matter is that the UN used to be a place that was primarily a talking shop, and it had certain legislative pretensions. But it's increasingly become a place that does things. And just a couple of examples. The UN now oversees 18 peacekeeping operations around the world. It has over 70,000 troops in the field, probably will soon have more than 100,000 troops around the world performing peacekeeping operations, largely with some success, and often being asked to do things that are extremely difficult, as is the case in Lebanon, where I think your caller is right. The mandate for this Lebanon mission was in the early 1980s and remains today unfulfillable by anybody, not just the United Nations, but by even militarily capable states. But the point is that the UN is doing all this, and the UN's military forces deployed overseas are second only to American forces. Mm. So it's actually very active. It's also very active in helping countries prepare elections, eradicating smallpox in places like India, HIV/AIDS. I mean, it does a lot of things. Now, to the point about it being useless, I mean, the degree to which the UN is ineffective is partly a function of corruption, cronyism, bad management, and it's partly a function of deliberate choices. Because, does the United States want the UN to be effective? how independent does the United States want the UN to be? This has been a big debate in the United States and elsewhere. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, there are only 600 people in the Department of Peacekeeping Operations at the United Nations who are overseeing the 70,000 troops deployed.
Compared to our jam-packed Pentagon with lots and lots and lots of people overseeing American deployments.
Well, our overstretched Pentagon, frankly. But yes, I mean, the point is that to a certain extent, and we have to be honest about this, the UN is ineffective as a result of the deliberate choices of the UN's members, not just the United States, but certainly principally the United States.
Let's go to Dubuque, Iowa. Joe's calling. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you see, Joe?
We've got a great nation, and it can be so much better yet. We've made our mistakes, but we need to get off of our high horse and humble ourselves. I didn't vote for George Bush, but I don't care who's in office. This country needs to go forward and ask the world powers, the whole world at the United Nations, ask for some help. I know that when you deal with people, and if you ask for help, people will help you. This country is going bankrupt, not just monetarily, but in a lot of other degrees. And I think that Mr. Bush today needs to ask for world help and making peace in this world.
Joe, let us pick that straight up, and thanks for your call from Dubuque. Thomas Biersticker, how about it? If President Bush says, and it's hard to hear it in his voice, but if he said, we're in trouble and we need your help, whether he puts it that way or not, is the UN ready to stand up and respond and say, yes, we're there for you?
Well, I think that's probably fairly low probability argument we'll hear today. I do think, however, that's why I emphasized earlier that the tone of the address is always important. The UN is more than just a talking shop. It's a symbolic forum for the presentation of arguments and anything that could address the perception of arrogance and unilateralism, anything that would at least not perhaps humble, but at least reduce the tone of arrogance from the U.S. would in fact be taken up virtually as, I think, revolutionary amongst the members sitting in the audience.
Lee Feinstein, can you imagine, can you hear the president adopting a greater tone of humility here 4 years after the call to arms in Iraq?
Well, of course, that's what that's the campaign plank the president ran on as Governor Bush in 2000.
That's a long time ago now. A lot of water under that bridge.
Right, as a more humble power. And I think it's worth remembering that the problems that the United States had with the UN did not begin with this administration, and that the resentment of the rest of the world towards the United States is not a function of one administration. I think that problem has been exacerbated by this president, but it is inherent. It's a structural problem that the United States faces, and that's why diplomacy is really important. Because the truth is, the United States needs to and will do what it must in order to advance its principles, goals, values, and interests. It prefers to do that with others, and that requires leadership. And that means getting people to do things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise want to do, or making it a lot easier to, helping the medicine go down smoothly.
Lynn is calling right now from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Good morning. It's a beautiful morning here, and I just wanted to say I don't think our leadership is good, and what I'd like President Bush to say is to invite the Iranian president to dinner and start negotiating face-to-face. Generate a little real leadership. So, I'll take it off the air. Thanks, and great program.
Thank you. So, Lee Feinstein, how about it? Don't just go back-to-back or at opposite ends of the day with the Iranian president, but sit down with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Does that make sense in global diplomatic terms, given the stakes?
Well, first of all, I would not nor would I encourage President Bush to sit down with Ahmadinejad under any circumstances. But I would encourage what Secretary Rice said today, or earlier today, in fact, this morning, which was, if Iran can meet the status quo ante, the precondition, which it itself had accepted earlier, which is to stop its nuclear activities, then she said she would meet anywhere, any place, any time with her Iranian counterpart. That, I think, is absolutely the right approach. And I think there's a fallback, too. I think if Iran can't do that for whatever reason, I think that the EU and the United States should agree on some limited sanctions outside of the UN Security Council on their own, the four of them, apply some limited sanctions, and then say, okay, look, we've made our point. You didn't suspend. We needed to make it clear that for our own credibility that we're unhappy about that. We suspend. Now let's talk.
Let me just ask you, just to go to our caller's point, though. I mean, Reagan and Gorbachev went to Iceland, went to Reykjavik, and talked. In diplomatic terms or, you know, in international relations terms, why do you see that kind of approach as out of bounds here?
Well, let me put it this way. If Ahmadinejad were to repudiate some of his statements, which include wiping the United States off the face of the earth, people always focus on the fact that he talks about wiping Israel off the face of the earth. He also talked about wiping America off the face of the earth. If he were to repudiate these kinds of statements, then yes, absolutely. I think under the right circumstances, with a comprehensive agreement to stop Iran's nuclear program under a verifiable measure, then, you know, sure, you can contemplate a lot of different things. But under the present circumstances, with a radical, extremist, hateful person at the head of this government, although he was democratically elected, I could not see a circumstance in which it would make sense to meet with him.
Tom's calling from Boston. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of points I'd like to make, and then I'll take your answers off offline. First of all, it seems to me that Bush has never come to grips with the fact that democracy is not a be-all and end-all in terms of making the world and the U.S. safe, because democracy often means that you have anti-U.S. Governments, like we do in Iran, like we do with Hamas, Hezbollah, Chavez in Venezuela. So I think he needs to deal with that as an issue, because just saying that democracy protects us is not really true, and I think he has very little credibility on that point. The second point I'd like to make is that, you know, we dealt with the Russians for years during the Cold War, and they had a very expansionist military philosophy, and they certainly posed a much greater military threat to the United States. But that did not stop us from talking to them and trying to negotiate mutually agreeable pacts.
Yeah, Tom, we've got it. Let us pick those up, and thanks for your call. Thomas Bierstecker, what about the president's freedom agenda and democracy for the Middle East at the center of that? Our caller, Tom, says, well, you know, that can cut two ways. It may not be the best thing to be pushing. Do you see the UN buying the president's view there?
Well, just to comment analytically on the point, I think it's the question about democracy not being a be-all and end-all. It sort of turns on what one defines as democracy. Simply holding elections isn't necessarily democracy. But I think what is perhaps more important over the long term is while it's important to have, I think, very much so support for the spread of democracy globally, I think one also has to be cognizant of the fact that there are many different institutional forms and paths to democracy, that one size doesn't necessarily fit all, and that democracy itself is essentially an ongoing and unfinished process, and that's true even in the United States.
So that leaves the president talking about a freedom agenda. Lee Feinstein, you're at the Council on Foreign Relations. The president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, has written, democracy is difficult to spread and impossible to impose. It is one thing to seek to promote democratic values worldwide and quite another to think that this can be accomplished by force of arms. Where does the General Assembly stand on this? Are they with the president or against him when he rolls out a freedom agenda and puts democracy at the heart of it?
Well, depending on how you do your bookkeeping, a majority or an overwhelming majority of the members of the United Nations are now partially or are mostly free, according to Freedom House, which is a nonpartisan research organization in the United States. So I would say if you look at what they do, you can see that people that members of the United Nations believe that democratic governance is the best path to prosperity and the happiness of their people. I also think if you look at some of the polls last month, 2 months ago actually, the Pew Research Center did a poll of Muslims in the West and Muslims also in the Muslim world, and they overwhelmingly believe that democracy is a system of government that can work for them as well. So I think it's a false notion to say that this idea of democracy is something that just President Bush supports.
Well, on its face, great to have. I guess it's the issue of what you do with it. I mean, a freedom agenda, implicit in that is kind of direction, is volition. What your colleague Richard Haass has said is that it's difficult to spread and impossible to impose. Not that democracy is bad, but that if you set out to impose it, especially by force of arms, in the Middle East in particular, you may be in trouble. So is the president going to have a receptive ear for this as a Middle East action agenda, Lee?
Well, of course, Richard Haass is my colleague and my boss. But having said that, let me disagree slightly
with
my boss on
that subject. We'll test your diplomatic skills then.
I think there are few people who dispute the democracy peace theory, you know, this theory that democracies are less likely to go to war with one another. So I think that absolutely needs to be the goal. And I think if you look at the experience of the 1970s in terms of agreements and efforts to promote democracy within the former Soviet Union and within the satellite countries of the Soviet Union, you saw that over time these countries first of all signed up to democratic principles and then felt pressure to live up to them. So I actually think that over time this is the right approach. Now, that is a separate question from what you do in the meantime and how you pursue these goals in the meantime. And I would agree that, you know, democracy at the end of the point of a gun is a difficult thing. You know, it can work. It has worked, of course. It worked in the case of Germany and Japan. But, of course, that was after those regimes were thoroughly defeated in World War II, and then there was a 50-year-plus occupation that followed thereafter. So, you know, you have to tailor your approaches to different circumstances. You have to take a long-term view in terms of democracy, and also you have to have policies in the short run that meet your goals. So democracy doesn't solve all your problems. It's hard to do, but it is a fundamental piece of the diplomatic puzzle.
Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut, on the president at the UN. Sam is on the line. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I'm glad that you took my phone. What I'm trying to say is that trying to suggest that the president should come up front and acknowledge his mistake by going to Iraq unilaterally and ask for the UN member for help to win this war in Iraq. I think that is a way to win the heart of the United Nations.
Sam, we've got it. Thomas Bierstecker, a snowball's chance that the president will say Iraq was wrong and now we need your help?
Definitely a snowball's chance. There, of course, would be ways of acknowledging that the UN could be helpful and could provide assistance in Iraq, and therefore and doing it in a way that simply isn't following the U.S. lead or leadership, but is in fact consulting with others, working with others, trying to define how to deal with an obviously terribly difficult and reportedly worsening situation and condition. I wouldn't expect to hear that in this morning's address. This is the kind of thing that would probably be unlikely in this administration. Nevertheless, it I think ultimately will be essential to at least begin quietly in diplomatic corridors, begin to start talking about ways of engaging others in the solution to the problem of the occupation.
Let's get an international view from Ontario, Canada. Albert's on the line. Hi, Albert. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. How
yes.
are you?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, well, I'm listening to your discussion, and I'm flabbergasted by the blinders that your experts have on, and I just cannot understand.
Give us your Canadian perspective, Albert. Let's hear it.
Well, most of my friends are really looking at your country and completely seeing the opposite from what's happening from your leadership. That is the spin that is coming on. It's not just Iraq. I can tell you that your country has aggressive stance towards Canada, okay, in terms of its of the trade relationship, and it has a very aggressive stance towards the rest of the world in relation to the international law. So, you know, you cannot go to the United Nations, or your president cannot go to the United Nations and tell everybody what to do and read the Riot Act to the world, okay? Because you know what the world is going to do? They're going to laugh at you and give you a finger. So you won't have enough Marines to control the world.
So how do you see the president's challenge at the UN? What would bring some comfort to your Canadian ear?
Right now, he has to invite the Iranian leadership, okay, and have and break some bread with them and talk to them. He is not going to get anywhere in this world if he starts to call people's names and all this other stuff. Okay,
Albert, in Ontario, we've got it. There's a tough judgment from north of the border. Lee Feinstein, Albert says, look, you've got super huge credibility problems here. Don't think it's going to be easy at all. How do you gauge this administration for global leadership when you feel that kind of resistance? And you've both said that President Bush is likely to face it on the floor at the General Assembly. What kind of grades do you give this White House on global leadership for the United States, for the world? Lee.
I think it's much, much harder for the United States to play a leadership role in the world today than it was 6 years ago. There's just no question about it.
Harder because the world has changed, or harder because they've made a rough nest for themselves, this administration?
Well, I'd say it's both. I would say, the kind of comment that our Canadian colleague just made was also being made about the United States in 2000 when Bill Clinton was president. You would be surprised. I was involved in many efforts to negotiate international agreements with the Canadians, with the European Union, at the United Nations and others on a whole range of what I would call second-tier issues, including the issue that Tom works on now and some other related questions. And it was increasingly difficult to get agreement with other countries on a whole set of issues. Now, that was partly because we had divided government in the United States and we had a Republican Congress, and it was so very hard for President Clinton to take stands that he might have wanted to. But it also reflected an inevitable tension between, number one, and everybody else. And that is the price. It's a happy person's problem, but that is the challenge of leadership. Now, this president has made things much worse and unnecessarily so. And if you look, for example, at the same another recent poll by the German Marshall Fund this past summer about Europeans and the desirability they see for American leadership. I also think it included Canadians as well. In 2002, about two-thirds of West Europeans and Canadians believed that a leadership role for the United States in the world was desirable. And today, that two-thirds is now one-third. This is a really serious problem. And it's a serious problem not just for us, but it's a serious problem for the world. Because, unfortunately, when the United States does not have a lot of leverage, is not engaged, is not leading, it's very difficult to accomplish goals that we can and should support.
Well, two-thirds to one-third, that is a temperature dropping in a very real way. It's clear, I think, at this point that we're not going to get to President Bush from the General Assembly floor in this hour. He's nowhere near the podium yet. But Thomas Bierstecker, if you could whisper in the president's ear, I don't know, in the minute we've got, what's the single most important theme he might sound to put the U.S. sort of in better standing with the community he's facing today?
Well, it's a challenging task. I suppose I would, again, as I said earlier, say sound a tone of reconciliation, acknowledgement of the fact that the U.S. can't do everything on its own, that it needs the United Nations, and that it's willing to and interested in working cooperatively with the rest of the member states in the organization. That would be the main broad theme I would recommend.
Lee Feinstein, do you hear anything like that? Do you imagine it coming from this president? Anything that might pump that one-third support back up toward the two-thirds it had half a dozen years ago?
Well, as I said, I think it's probably too late for this president to take any steps that would really broaden international support. I thought that Kofi Annan last night said something very interesting, which was he called on the rest of the world to help in Iraq. And I think that is something that would genuinely pay dividends if the rest of the world could provide some support, not necessarily militarily, but otherwise, to improve the lives of ordinary Iraqis.
Lee Feinstein at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, thanks for being with us this hour. And Thomas Bierstecker joining us from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. It looks like we won't get to the president in this hour after all, but he will be speaking today, and you've both been very helpful to us in anticipating that speech and seeing the surround. Thomas, thanks very much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.